You are listening to Radio Albion.
Hello and welcome to yet another edition of the Orthodox Nationalist. Of course, I am Matthew Raphael Johnson, Radio Albion. And this is being recorded very early, Sunday morning, March 22nd, 2026. And I promised you I'm not dealing with Iran anymore. That'll be a little while before I'm forced to go back to that for some crazy reason, but before I get into what we are dealing with, don't forget, I have a new book out. It is selling halfway decently, but when you guys buy it, and if you like it, please give it a review. That has something to do with the algorithm that I don't totally understand, how Amazon works. This is a book that, as soon as I was finished with it, I went to the hospital. I'm not saying there's a connection. I don't think there was, but I am extremely proud of this book, and a huge number of hours went into it, even more so than my earlier books. My earlier books, years and years ago, were quite sloppy. I recognize that. I'm always a late bloomer in these things, but and as always, thank you for all of my to all of my donors in my acknowledgement page in the new book. I mentioned that as well. How could I not? So, I'm going back to something that's extremely important. I'm going back to something that changed European politics for a long time. It might be familiar to you. I've dealt with this around the edges, but not directly. I want to talk about the defection of the Cossack Hetman Ivan Mazepa in 1708 and its consequences. Under the Petrine yoke, Peter the Great, the Tsar, who eventually took the title emperor, was a man devoid of compassion. He was devoid of empathy, Christianity. He was devoid of sympathy and respect for others. For him, the men around him were just vehicles to be used, which, quite frankly, is a vice you could find in all revolutionary leaders. And this is how he created enemies that really never needed to be enemies, such as Hetman Ivan Mazepa, as the 18th century dawned. Under no circumstances did this man ever seek the war his defection from Peter caused. But I think very few would have done differently. Peter was terrifying. He was a terrifying ruler, and in Ukraine was in the process of depopulating its best men for his wars and construction projects that, quite frankly, didn't benefit Ukraine at all. In the early 18th century, very early 18th century, Ukraine, the Hetmanate, was on the brink of total exhaustion and collapse. Again, this is because the Hetmanate, the Cossacks, Ukraine to Peter, just a source of men and supplies for his ambitions on the battlefield. Elite Cossacks were sent all over the western borders to fight Peter's enemies, and casualties were very, very high. Cossack numbers were dwindling. In the same way, the Ukrainian economy, just a source for raw materials. Cossack freedoms were gradually being canceled, and even serfdom loomed. Eventually, of course, Mazepa will defect from Peter as the armies of Charles XII of Sweden drew closer. Now, the Hetman is simply not large enough to really be independent, something on its own. It needs strong allies, and it's made some incredibly dumb decisions in its history. it allowed a huge Turkish army onto its territory under Hetman Doroshenko. Throwing his lot in with the Swedes, Ivan Mazepa invited defeat. Many of the Hetmans went to Poland, of all places. And of course, we know today, the Jewish clique who runs Ukraine threw in their lot with those most like them, the regime, the ruling class in the U.S. and elsewhere. There was something interesting that happened, though. Peter the Great, who was a hater of the church, except when he, you know, had to look pious, he demanded that his clergy write and proclaim an anathema to him that up until maybe 100 years ago was in the, you know, the Sunday of Orthodoxy list of anathemas. Let me read a bit from that right now. The new traitor, known as Ivashka Mazepa, former Ukrainian hetman, or rather, the forerunner of the Antichrist, a fierce wolf disguised sheepskin and hidden thief, a serpent's vessel, externally glittering with gold, adorned with honor and splendor, yet internally filled with all manner of impurity, treachery, devilish malice, cunning, falsehood, enmity, hatred, torture, bloodshed, and murder. Spawn of vipers. Like a cunning serpent, he conceals his venomous plot against the Orthodox state. And through his long reign, a vomit of the past year, December 1708, disdaining so many blessings of God and the sovereign's extreme, ineffable mercy and love, honored by him with his supreme position, he sided with the Swedish king, Charles, the enemy of God and his saints, a heretic, and sent him into the little Russian land where he desecrated and destroyed the Church of God in holy places. Therefore, as a son of perdition for such treason, apostasy in the pious state, betrayal and the raising of the hands of robbers of war against Christ our Lord, his benefactor and sovereign, let him be cursed with all of his like-minded people, scoundrels, and traitors. Now that's an abbreviated version. It's much longer than that. Now, that was written by Metropolitan Joseph Krakowski, who was at the time Metropolitan of Kiev, Galicia, and Little Russia, November 12, 1708. That's what made this situation a little different. Now, I have to say that I don't think anyone outside of Russia accepted him that way and added Mazepa to the list. But I'll have more to say about that in a little bit. But it was very easy, if you're Ukrainian, a Cossack or no, why are you fighting for the greater glory of someone like Peter? On the other hand, attempt to provoke the temper of a man like that, a man who had his own son tortured to death for his treason, was to invite even worse reprisals. I mean, Mazepa's gamble wasn't just for him, but for all of Ukraine, and he lost. And that's the precise purpose of this broadcast today, to explain in some detail the response of Peter to Hetman Mazepa's eventual defection, the agonizing nature of its consequences, once it became clear he and his Swedish allies had lost badly on the battlefield. The year 2026, not the first time Ukraine has been depopulated. Peter's near genocidal reaction is just one aspect of his regime showing him to be a revolutionary. The other thing that made this defection different than many others was that no one was considered more loyal than Hetman Mazepa. It took a long time for Peter for this to penetrate his brain. Actually, it took quite a while. And in fact, he even wrote that he must have just disappeared or something like that. But Peter was incapable of any kind of introspection. But as the Swedes under Charles XII, he abandoned the Tsar for the Swedish army. Khmelnytsky himself had done this under Charles X, actually. Sweden was powerful, but far enough away where they wouldn't really be able to occupy Ukraine. He considered Mazepa to be the most loyal of all the men that he had around him. The man who gave him the news, a treacherous man himself, Alexander Menshikov, who died in 1729. He told Peter that the hetman had completely betrayed him. At the time, Peter was at the Novgorod-Tversky, near the border, actually. He issued a manifesto to the Ukrainian people on October 27th. And he said, "Hetman Mazepa has disappeared without a trace. We are sorry for that. Whether it is because of the work of some factions or some enemy, we don't know." He's still processing this concept. Mazepa had been loyal for a long time, putting down all the uprisings against Peter's state. But when your best men are defecting, this is the time to look at yourself and look at your policies. The only thing that Peter was capable of doing was doubling down. So he ordered the Cossack officers to appear before him. And he wasn't that far away, as I mentioned. Novgorod-Tversky is just not too far from the border. And he said to them, and this is a direct quote, "If he, the hetman, shows ultimate infidelity, then there'll be election of a new one." In other words, he still hasn't grasped it yet. It took until the next day, maybe the day after, it finally sunk in. Peter then issued a new manifesto and informed the country, Ukraine in particular, that Mazepa, quote, was betrayed. He defected to our enemy, the Swedish king, according to an agreement with him and the Polish monarch, Leszczynski, in order to, by common consent with them, enslave little Russian land, as before under Polish rule, and to give the Church of God and the holy monasteries to that union. That union, by the way, in his mind, could be the unions, or it could be the union of Poland and Lithuania. Either way, it means the same thing. I was reading Sergei Plokhy, who I haven't read for quite some time, and he has an article now, more recently, about the concept of fatherland, i.e. the nation, in these discussions. Peter started using the term fatherland. I mean, similar terms have been used before, but this is a word that Peter used over and over again. That concept became the cornerstone of attempts to both legitimize and discredit Ivan Mazepa's uprising against the Tsar in 1708, as Plokhy argued. The Tsar almost never used the term in any kind of official correspondence. Now it emerged in his manifesto. And he wanted to tell the Cossacks that he was the champion of their fatherland and the little Russian people in general. So it was October 28, 1708. That's the first thing that, the first circular that Peter wrote, where he finally realized the truth. He presented the hetman's actions as a betrayal of his oath of personal loyalty. There were other arguments that Peter used, though. The first was related to the nature of the Russian protectorate over the hetmanate, over the Cossacks, and that was established in the days of Khmelnytsky. And there, the Tsar was to protect Ukraine from the Polish threat and even the Turkish threat to the Orthodox people. Charles XII was at war with the Russian Empire. And the Poles, under King Stanislaw Leszczynski. Because of this situation, he wanted to talk more about the fatherland. Either the fatherland on the one hand, or personal loyalty on the other. He accused Mazepa of attempting to subjugate the little Russian land to the Poles and Orthodox churches over to the Union. As protector of the little Russian land, the Tsar declared his determination to prevent this enslavement and destruction of Ukraine and the desecration of God's churches. He also wanted to promote himself as a protector of Ukraine against abuses of power by the Cossack administration. this alleged betrayal of the Tsar's interests and ill treatment of the Zaporozhian host, Little Russian people. This is among the reasons cited by the Russians and Peter himself for the removal in 1687 of Mazepa's predecessor, Ivan Samoilovich. Now it was Mazepa's turn to be accused of things like heavy taxes for his own enrichment. So these were all, in one form or another, in the various circulars that Peter issued in late October and early November 1708. Now, if you're a Cossack colonel, was the head of a regiment, it'd be something along the lines of a governor, in our case. Of course, it couldn't be much division. Peter sent personal invitations. This is late October. He sent personal invitations to these colonels, which the opinion of whom was very, he was very concerned with. And they were promised the Tsar's high mercy and all kinds of awards, not to mention the highest Ukrainian clergy, Metropolitan of Kiev, as I mentioned, Joseph, Archbishop of Chernigov, Ivan Maximovich, and Bishop Zakhari of Pereslav. Then the Ataman of the Zaporozhye, Kosta Hodienko, a very well-educated Cossack who defected with Mazepa. And these same circulars were sent to individual cities as well. It's probably going too far to call this a propaganda campaign. But if it was, it's, you know, Mazepa did his own. There's also a new hetman that they elected, Ivan Skoropadsky, a distant relative of the great Hetman Skoropadsky, that I've talked about quite a bit, the end of World War I. Peter saw Hetman Ivan as an ally, of course, against Charles XII and Hetman Mazepa. And certainly they wanted to influence the attitude of not just any Ukrainian, but those who were armed, the Cossacks and those who were veterans. The Tsar ordered the capture of the Hetman's capital, Batutin. That's where the main Ukrainian artillery stores were, stocks of gunpowder and ammunition, the treasury, archives of the Ukrainian government, many other things. Mazepa left the defense of Batutin to the Swedes. Mazepa entrusted the defense of his own residence to Colonel Dmitry Chichel and a few others, and four regiments were also stationed there. You had a handful of others, totaling around 3,000 men. The garrison was ordered to defend the fortress from Peter's forces and at least hold out until the Hetman returned with the Swedish army, the main Swedish army. And it was carried out. Menshikov, Prince Golitsyn, they approached Batutin with 10,000 men. The Batutin fortifications were not substantial. So on the morning of November 1st, that's where the battle began. There were several offers of surrender, but they very wisely rejected them. On the night of November 2nd, the Russian army went on the offensive, and after 2 hours, thanks to the help of some on the inside who wanted to support not so much Peter, but Russia in general, the regimental messenger Ivan Nosh, they eventually captured his capital. The capital of the Hetman, with all of its institutions, the Hetman's palace, all the churches that he had built, the state library, the magazines of weapons equal to any in Europe, everything that Mazepa had gathered there during his 20-year rule was destroyed. We call this the sack of Batutin. Unfortunately, some Russian nationalists want to reject and claim that this never happened. It did. I have to be fair. I'm a historian. I have to be fair here. Too many contemporary sources testify to the total destruction of the city and its population in early November 1708 under Menshikov. In Harvard Ukrainian Studies, you have the article from 2010, The Rape of Baturin, the Archaeological Evidence, written by Vladimir Kovalenko. You had plenty of Swedes who saw the burning of Baturin with their own eyes. Foreign diplomats connected both to Sweden and Moscow reported this to their governments. The Prussian ambassador, Kaiserling, wrote on November 28, 1708, Menzikoff and Baturin, all things were massacred. The castle and the city were plundered. The English ambassador, Whitworth, also says the same thing. And frankly, Russian sources don't disagree. This was a slaughter. In the Zugubovsky Chronicle, we read this. Many people in Baturin perished by the sword because the fire was from all the villages. Many people drowned, fleeing through the still fragile ice. Many burned, hiding in their homes and cellars, pits. They were eventually suffocated. The homes they burned, because although the slaughter was to stop the bloodshed, the army that came out from undercover was exhausted. Even ordinary soldiers, having drunk, stabbed, and chopped people, for this reason being afraid, others sat in hidden places until the fire went around the entire city, and those who were hidden suffered from this. So if you hid somewhere, the fire is going to get you. And this was destroyed on Peter's explicit order. We have the correspondence between Peter and Menshikov, November 5th, 1708. Peter says, as far as Baturin is concerned, as a sign to the traitors, because they defended themselves, burn it all as an example to others. A handful of the population were able to escape, and many of those fell into captivity for many years. Russian forces threatened other Ukrainian cities with the fate of Baturin. That became a slogan later on if they disobeyed the Petrine state. With the destruction, this tragic fate of the Cossack capital, I'm not talking about Zaporozhye, of course, I'm talking about in Ukraine proper, always two hetmanates. The tragic fate of Baturin was a huge blow to the Ukrainian cause in general. This was a Swedish participant in the campaign, Colonel Count Ilin Stierne, wrote the following. The massacre committed there brought such terror to the entire country that not only did most of Ukraine, including those who, out of sympathy for the Swedes, decided to revolt, remain in their homes, but also the overwhelming number of troops that had come to the Swedes with Mazepa went over to the enemy, that is to say, Russia, and this caused great shortages and obstacles in all of our later actions. Now, if you know anything about Peter the Great, you know how his later investigations and punishments were to go. People who were involved, or even remotely suspected of being involved, in Mazepa's treason or defection. The Tsar had moved his residence to Lebedin, very close to the border of the Hetmanate. But of course, as I've said earlier, holding elections for a new hetman was of extreme importance. There were a few options. Obadovsky, Voinarovsky, maybe. Voinarovsky couldn't be a candidate, either age or merit. A man had to be from the highest Ukrainian elders. A man of great government experience and authority, of good fortune, and most importantly, a candidate acceptable for the rest of the Cossacks, to Moscow and even to Mazepa. There was only one person, as I said, who fits that, and that was Ivan Skoropadsky. And he was known in Moscow circles, even from Mazepa's recommendation, even after the sacking. Dashkov wrote to Golovkin, if Skoropadsky is elected as hetman, they should keep an eye on him, because he is Mazepa's creature. He raised him and taught him. So it's really not shocking when Peter learned of Mazeppa's defection, Scotopazzi was seen very negatively. And in fact, the Tsar had designated Dmitri Apostle as Mazeppa's successor. Of course, Peter didn't know that Apostle was already with Mazeppa in the Swedish camp. There was very few colonels to choose from at the time. Stardubivka, Ivan Scotopazzi, Pavel Polubotok of Chernigov, the acting colonels of Pereslav, Tamara, and Zirokovsky of Nizhny Novgorod. They appeared at this famous council of Glukiev that Gogol made famous, actually. Kulish. The Poltava colonel, Ivan Levinets, he just wanted to see. He just wanted to wait. And then he said, well, I have to go defend Poltava, so he didn't go to the council. Those on the right bank, or the sort of the Polish side of things, simply didn't take part in the elections. Polubotok, despite his old enmity with Mazeppa, he still seemed like a problem to Peter, and he had many family ties to Mazeppa's supporters. So Skotopadzki was really by a matter of elimination. He was older. He had tremendous experience, was respected by the elders, was well known in Moscow, and had proven his loyalty to the Tsar at the critical moment in the struggle for the Siversk region. So he was elected, or really appointed, by Peter. Skotopadzki died in 1722, reigning from 1708 to 1722. He was over 60, which is not a big deal back then, but he had many dozen years of seniority. He was a native of Uman. He moved to the left bank, the Russian side of Ukraine, 1674, and worked under Samulovitz, and he rose up through the ranks. He was intelligent, he was tactful, and he was very good in diplomacy. Samulovitz gave him many assignments to Moscow throughout the 1670s. He was sent to Crimea in 1681 with negotiations there that ended with the peace of Bakhchisarai. His official career was greatly helped by his marriage to the daughter of the Chernigov regimental coachman, Kalinichenko, a very wealthy man, in fact. The future hetman, at his wedding in 1678, he had very little. He had one servant and a four-horse team. Well, his new father-in-law is going to fix that. So in 1699, his father-in-law said, you know, out of respect for the great, hard-working general of the army, Ivan, who entered us, Peter saying this, out of respect for the great, hard-working general of the army, Ivan, who rendered us significant and hard-working services, support and assistance, and full power and possession. And then Peter listed a bunch of villages that had previously belonged to Kalinichenko of Ashkiv. Then he married again to a daughter yet of another wealthy Pritusk man, Mark Avramovich Makovich. The widow of a former Cossack general, 1678-1687, Konstantin Hulub. That was also Samulovich's brother-in-law. So his property status went from nothing too extraordinary. Her name was Nastasia Markievna. So for having one, you know, servant and four horses, and that's it, he became, well, not quite like Mazeppa, but he became a very wealthy man very quickly. Now, before he was elected all hetman by Peter, he was appointed to the Starodub regiment by Mazeppa, meaning that he completely trusted him. Why? Because that particular regiment was a very important economic part of the Hetmanate. It was right on the border. It has special political and strategic significance. The support of the Stadtische elders, the patriciate in the city, very important for Mazeppa. So pretty much everyone considered Skotopadzki as a reliable executor of Mazeppa's policy, whether it be towards Russia or anything else. So he wrote to him October 30th, 1708, from the Swedish camp, Mazeppa. Said, I want you to try to, by all means, according to the reason and art given to you by God, to eradicate the Muscovite army from Stadlerdrup. If to eradicate that Moscow garrison remaining there, there's not enough strength or means, then we advise to leave and join our side in Batutin with a company of soldiers so that we not fall into Russian hands with our incredible regret. Kudapatsky, of course, never received this letter. He was surrounded by the Russian army. He couldn't have done it anyway. The Swedes knew that Kudapatsky was a supporter of Mazeppa. But even in this very difficult spot, Kudapatsky did everything he could to defend the interests of the Ukrainian Orthodox state. And this is something I fully support. I've defended in my book, Ukrainian Nationalism, and many other places. But the Petrian government never quite trusted him. There were many denunciations against him, some unfounded, some not, about his friendly attitude towards Mazeppa. There were many who remained in the Hetmanate. Even among his generals, Kudapatsky avoids the official terminology, you know, calling him traitor and snake or whatever. No, he used phrases like the former Hetman or even our predecessor. So even among those connected to Mazeppa, even in the emigration after the war was over, Kudapatsky was considered a good man. Now, the way Peter thinks, he thought it necessary not to just destroy the Hetman physically, but destroy his image, destroy him as a person. I mean, Peter tried to get him alive, you know, many, many, many times. The punishment in absentia was carried out according to a very detailed ceremonial. The crowning glory of this annihilation of Mazeppa was the Tsar's order to the highest church authorities. Of course, I'm referring to the anathema. Having abandoned Orthodoxy, went to the heretics, the Swedes. And in spite of the fact that he was a great builder of holy churches, now he is a cursed persecutor of them. Because not far from Novogorsk, the Swedes put horses in one church. And that was an order to the Metropolitan of Ryazan, Stefan Yavorsky, October 31st, 1708. Of course, Yavorsky is going to become very famous very soon. And it was carried out. In the Dormition Cathedral, November 12, 1708, that's the place of the coronation of Moscow czars and emperors, the presence of the episcopate, thought of its Alexei, boyars, many other powerful men, Metropolitan Stefan Yavorsky, a Ukrainian, longtime friend of Mazeppa, transferred the rite of the curse, or the anathema, for the conversion of the Russians and for the Russians, the one who had always been faithful son of the Orthodox Church and the greatest of all Ukrainian hetmans, its benefactor, Mazeppa. In Glukov, the Trinity Cathedral, after the liturgy and the prayer service, in the presence of the Tsar, members of the Moscow government, Kudapatsky was there, elders, the highest Ukrainian clergy, Joseph Krakowski, as I mentioned, delivered the anathema. So even these letters to the episcopate, they were this anathema was extended to all who followed Mazeppa. This was included in the Rite of Orthodoxy. The name of Hetman Mazeppa was mentioned annually during that very same rite, the Rite of Orthodoxy, the first Sunday of Great Lent. No Orthodox church ever really recognized it outside of Russia. But it has to be pointed out that whether invalid or not, it made a tremendous impression on the Ukrainian Orthodox people. Now, is he still mentioned in that rite? Not really. This is a rite that I got from Jordanville, which I think is authoritative. Russian Orthodox Church outside of Russia. Let me quote it directly. It's in English. To those who reason that Orthodox sovereigns are elevated to their thrones not by God's special goodwill for them, that the gifts of the Holy Spirit are not poured out upon them during the anointing for the fulfillment of this great calling, and who likewise dare to rise up against them in revolt and betrayal, anathema. Well, he doesn't mention Mazeppa by name, but the mentality is still there. Now, I said this before, but I can't believe as in terms of not just the anathema, the memory eternal, and the praises. I'll quote it directly to the most right-believing sovereign emperors, Peter I, Peter II, Peter III, Paul I, Alexander I, Nicholas I, Alexander II and III, to the most pious sovereign empresses, Catherine I, Anna Ivanovna, Elizabeth Petrovna, Catherine II, Elizabeth, Alexandra Fedorovna, and Maria Alexandrovna, memory eternal. Many of the above are manifest heretics and destroyers of the church. But I understand the church doesn't want to get involved with a very deep historical analysis. Well, I've done that already. But it conflicts with the anathema against Freemasons and the anathema that says to the persecutors of the Church of Christ, the impious apostates who have lifted their hands against the anointing of God and who slay the sacred ministers. Peter destroyed the entire Russian episcopate and just had his own people replace them. And that happened more than once. Under Anna, or the two Annas, the German Freemasons were permitted to rule, and who also despoiled the church. We're at a point where even the population of Russia began to fall. Interestingly, the specific mention of Mazeppa that has been resurrected, it hasn't really been part of the Russian rite for about 150 years, 140 years maybe, but Archbishop Justinian of Tiraspol and Dubasari has had it returned and has inserted it in the first Sunday of Great Lent. Anyway, here's a problem that people who were following Mazeppa had. You had the concentration of the Russian army in the Hetmanate, the destruction of the capital, of course, the election of a new Hetman, and now the church anathema against Mazeppa. That puts Mazeppa and his followers in a very, very bad spot. Now, the French ambassador, Pierre de Besenval, he wrote to the foreign minister, Jean-Baptiste Colbert, the Marquis de Torcy, in late November 1708. I'll say it frankly. If the Ukrainian nation does not support the Swedish king, I see no possibility for him to end the war happily, although the population is hostile to the Russians. I don't know how he knows that, but it's interesting, and it certainly is from someone who was there. But Ukraine couldn't support the Swedish king. It was deeply divided, ideologically in many other ways, and beyond that, from the very first days of the war. See, in the territory that was occupied by Sweden, Mazeppa's government operated there. But in a much larger territory occupied by the Russians, you had the government of Hetman Skoropadsky, carrying out the orders of the Tsar, and of course, he had many local privileges as well. And both sides continuously trying to win over the mentality of the population, or at least people in the country who mattered. One side promised liberation from the Russian yoke, the other liberation from the Poles. Peter wrote in his manifesto November 6, 1708, "No other people under the sun can boast of such freedoms and privileges and such ease as Little Russia by the Tsar's Majesty's grace." The political division of Ukraine between these two powers. Then there was a new one, a new factor. The devastation that had begun even before Mazeppa's break with Moscow. Many in the country were opposed to the Ukrainian-Swedish Union. Numerous loyal declarations of Ukrainian cities, places like Lubin and Novgorod-Tversky, in full regiments that were written for the defense against Russia and, of course, a deterrent to Poland and anyone else. The senior officers were not present. Some of them were with Mazepa in the Swedish camp. And, of course, all of them, I've said this 100 times, both in, you know, in my book, Ukrainian Nationalism, which if you haven't gotten it, please buy it. These were believers in Ukrainian autonomy. None of them believed in total absorption or anything like that. They were very jealous of the privileges that they had in these areas. And there was tremendous anxiety for the beloved, quote, little Russian region of our homeland. The Russian government was most concerned with the position of the Ukrainian staryshna, that is to say, the elders. The elders should be respected because these were the men who had been on many campaigns and survived. They were taken very seriously. When you see an old man in a field where most die young, you shut up and listen. The entire Ukrainian government, most of the colonels, many other representatives of the staryshna aristocracy, I don't want to say all of them, but they were in the Swedish camp, some of them. Many who were sympathizers moved as far away as possible from the territory. Some ended up on the right bank in the Polish territory, or Polish-influenced territory, I should say. Many supported Russia, if not Peter. Many waited on their estates until the smoke cleared. So they were all over the place. So they were up for grabs, in other words. The Russian policy in Ukraine, 1708-1709, this was aimed at attracting Ukrainian officers so as to deprive Mazepa of political support. November 1st, 1708, Peter addressed the entire officer corps with an ultimatum. You show loyalty to us, the Tsar, and you leave the Hetman and the Swedes within 1 month. Those who don't will serve against us and as our enemy. We declare traitors to our people and your homeland, ranks and properties. All their belongings will be taken away and distributed among the people for their services. Also, their wives and children will be taken and exiled. And those of them who are caught will be executed without mercy as traitors. Hetman Skoropadsky said the same thing, November 7th, 1708. So, of course, it's going to have a huge effect on the Cossack elite. Many went to the side of Moscow. Making matters worse, you're starting to see desertion among the officers who were connected to the Swedish camp. Colonels Apostol, Ivan Sulim, the company Colonel Galagan, as well as Corson Colonel Kandiba, they went back to Russian authority and, in fact, took an active part in the fight against the Swedes and Mazepa. There's a whole bunch who kind of had similar intentions. Whether or not they were able to take advantage of it or not is a different story. A bit later, someone a little later, like Mikhail Hamalia, waited a little bit. You had a whole bunch returning to the Moscow camp on the day of the Battle of Poltava. Clearly, Sweden was losing. Now, keep in mind, I have a lengthy discussion on the Battle of Poltava, the Great Northern War, maybe last year sometime, maybe a little bit before then. That might give more details to this. So in 1708, you're seeing greater desertion among Cossacks. Mazepa's army, actually, you could even say it melted away. That means the Swedes were now distrustful towards their Ukrainian ally. And it affected their population, their attitude towards the local population. Relations between the Swedish army and the population of Ukraine got worse and worse. The population either remained passive and in many places opposed the Swedish detachments. The residents of the town of Piraten during the Swedish offensive there, quote, stood against them, did not let them into the city, and many Swedes were beaten and others were taken prisoner. The town of Smile, same thing. They refused to let in the Swedes, but they immediately opened the gate to the Russian general Rennes. The population of Vyprk in December 1708. They armed themselves to repel the Swedes. So many other places. The Swedish historian Alderfeld, actual participant in the campaign, says, "We were suddenly forced to fight all the time, as with enemies, with the population of the land that we had entered." In other words, I'm disappointed because I thought that they were going to love us as liberators, but they don't. Mazeppa's health was failing, and he was quite depressed, and he was shocked. But still, he began the winter campaign, 1708, 1709. He thought maybe this can do it. Now, the problem we have is that there are very few detailed, very few documents about the extensive diplomatic and administrative activities of the Hetman. They either just were destroyed, they slowly decayed later, they're somewhere in Moscow or even in foreign capitals, whatever. But the historian doesn't have a whole lot of contemporary Ukrainian memoirs. In fact, zero. And there's zero diaries, zero correspondence in this period of time. So the only thing a historian can do is reconstruct the course of events on the basis of foreign, often hostile sources. So we really don't know that much about the Ukrainian government and Mazeppa in this year-long period. B.D. Krupnitsky, a historian, says, "Mazeppa and the Ukrainians, oriented towards him, were looking for a way out. It seemed at a time of uniquely favorable European situation. Moscow's former allies had to retreat completely, forced to do so by the military genius of Charles XII. Poland was conquered. Neutral Prussia did not dare utter a word. Austria, France, England, Holland either clearly leaned towards the side of the Swedish king or did nothing to hinder him in his operational plans. Turkey was ready, at least in the case of success, to join this anti-Russian coalition." So in light of all this, the end of 1708, the events in Ukraine, as far as Charles XII were concerned, this was of purely local importance. So a new offensive was planned for the spring and summer of 1709. Now, as this was being built, he had very few men left. Many of them had left and joined the Russians. Skoropadsky was very active. He was not just doing because he was told to do it. He was opposed to what Mazeppa had done at this point. He was assisting the Russian army in every way he could. Mazeppa had a handful of men. I mean, a few elite regiments, and they were severely understaffed. The regimental system as a military force in Mazeppa's government, they ceased to exist. And, of course, the Swedes were well aware of it. The Swedes also did not make themselves particularly popular. Mazeppa needed to organize supply of food and fodder, you know, clothing, everything that was necessary for the smooth conduct of a military operation on the eve of a new offensive on Moscow. He knew these people were suffering, but that was very difficult. This task was almost impossible because most of the Hetman became a theater of military operations. Two Ukrainian governments existed on its territory. Now, the Swedish army, because they're Swedes, survived that particularly severe winter in Ukraine and remained a respectable fighting force. Mazeppa helped them with that. He could negotiate the topography and the various villages and make sure the Swedes were well cared for. In more general terms, though, Mazeppa, whose cultural significance could never be denied, he wanted to create not an oligarchy, but a true aristocracy. He wanted to strengthen the power of the Cossack elders, consolidating their lands, and actually transforming it into a ruling class, which in the history of Cossackdom seems contradictory, but The granting of estates to various elders and clergy, usually monasteries, was significantly increased. The population was either fleeing or simply going down. Mazeppa, already really the beginning of his rule, years prior to all this, he issued a whole bunch of decrees that confirmed old holdings or created new ones. He had the fund of the free military estates, that he called it. So land acquisition by elders and monasteries became widespread. But if you know anything about the Cossack, you know that agriculture wasn't really the main source of well-being. These elders, who had been through what they've been through, they devoted considerable attention to commercial, industrial operations. Vodka, tobacco, actually tar was a big one, generated profits for that class. But even rank and file soldiers, you know, benefited from this. The elders were developing industrial entrepreneurship in both the south and in the north of the Hetmanate. So that also means that if you're going to consolidate their lands, you're consolidating the power of these high-ranking officers. The regimental colonel had his power increased. And he used to be elected, but now he became the hereditary head of his regiment. You had elite companies that were completely exempt from local duties and jurisdiction, like the Bunchuk Company, a noble military company, only subject to the Hetman himself. That was called being under the Hetman's Bunchuk. The Bunchuk is the large mace, the symbol of Cossack power. And such a person can only be judged by the general court and by nothing local. But that land ownership concentration and political power, it had its drawbacks, including exploitation. During Mazeppa's reign, at least early on, peasant obligations, as far as anyone can tell, increased. Now, if they were monetized, that monetary rent increased. But more often than not, it's the corvée, paying taxes with labor. Now, usually monetary obligations predominated in the free military estates. But the increase in corvée was more characteristic of the large estates. It was pretty clear that you're looking at growing power of serfdom. Late 17th, early 18th century. Widespread discontent. You had uprisings against both the elders and Mazeppa. Now, Mazeppa was not stupid. He was also not immoral. He often intervened to curb the rulers' abusers and the exploitation of commoners. At the end of the 17th century, the standard amount of corvée labor in the left bank Ukraine increased to 2 days a week. In other words, two full days where you're not working for yourself, you're paying taxes through your labor to the regimental commander. But in practice, many rulers exceeded this, and they forced people to perform even more corvée labor. Keep in mind, too, because of Peter, as I mentioned very early on, Mazeppa was one of the wealthiest feudal lords in Europe. I mean, he was involved in tax farming, the wine trade, tobacco, tar, many things. Levies from the territorial regiments of the left bank Ukraine. And by the order of Peter, from 1704 on, regiments of the right bank too. 200,000 rubles a year. He owned estates so large that they contained a population of 100,000. Well, the point of all this is to give an impression that, you know, maybe there's some reasons why Mazeppa, as brilliant as he was in many other things, might be unpopular. And it might be very easy for the Russians to paint him as an oligarch. We're talking about, I mean, almost near the end here. Hetman sent trusted people the right bank to organize resistance to Moscow and to ensure communication with Poland and Turkey. That's not going to make him popular. Either one. You had Russian countermeasures, of course, the energetic activities of the Kiev governor, Prince Golitsyn. And many went over to Russia because they weren't going to deal with Poland anymore. A few others, the Chechen region, for example, supported Mazepa and remained loyal to him right up until the destruction of the Zaporozhian Sikh. I do want to point out that Mazepa wanted to destroy it. He did not, but he actually did at one point. His Cossack credibility was iffy. So, this Swedish Cossack alliance, such as it was, waited for help from Poland, even Turkey and Crimea. Well, that came in handy when they were running away and they had to, you know, flee to Turkey. But the center of Mazepa's diplomatic activities, 1708, early 1709, was his very grandiose plan to create this anti-Russian coalition. That was to include, in addition, obviously, to Ukraine and Sweden, and those Western states aligned with them, a number of Southern and Eastern European states, Turkey being one. That's not really too hard to envision. The Crimea, their vassal. Moldavia. Wallachia, Transylvania. The Kuban Caucasians. The Kalmyk Horde. Kazan Tartars. Bashkiria, and a handful of others. But only someone like Mazepa, I mean, whatever you might think of him, he combined high culture and experience with Western European politics with a deep knowledge of Eastern European, the Eastern European world, especially Russia. Only someone like him could conceive of this, and if he had more resources, would be able to pull it off. He never thought that the main enemy of Russia was Sweden or Poland, because at any time they could come to the understanding, you know, they could negotiate an end to the fighting, is unfortunately what happened under Catherine II. What Mazepa was looking at, the uprisings against, very localized uprisings against Russia, you saw this in Astrakhan, Bashkiria, even on the Don, and frankly, Ukrainian regiments were used to put him down. But despite that, Mazepa, now at this stage, thought maybe that he could now take advantage of them. Remember also, with the sack of Baturin, all of his artillery was gone. So now he's looking at, I don't care how brave the Swedish army was, they're cut off from their homeland, they're exhausted from a difficult campaign, they're dealing with an extremely hostile population, they cannot overcome the Russian army on their own. Russia had every advantage. So Mazepa, again, these were grandiose, and I mean that in a negative way, that he was, I don't want to say he was losing it, but this was an image that he had that he could never actually bring about. He wanted to create a new army reserve, a new armed force supporting the Swedish army, and even replace it at one point. He wanted to mobilize certain anti-Russian groups, as I mentioned, the east and southeast of Europe. The Sikh, of course, the Zaporozhians, the Don insurgents, led by Ignat Nekrasov, who was then in the Kuban, the Crimea, and even Turkey. And that's where his main diplomatic efforts were directed. So the Polish king and the Hetman considered their main task to expel the Russian army from Ukraine and transfer military operations, not just at the border, but beyond its borders, to the territory of Russia itself, having in mind a campaign straight to Moscow. Now, again, let's fantasy. But there was no way that could even be conceived of, considered logically, unless you had a new military coalition. Turkey and Crimea had to be a huge part of it. The expedition to incite the Don Cossacks, peoples of the North Caucasus, the Volga region. And of course, that was never going to happen. He thought it would. It didn't. November 30th, 1708. The Swedish army, especially the cavalry, was still in action. In November 30th, 1708, the Swedes wanted to occupy the town of Nedrigailov, but the inhabitants refused to let the Swedes in. The Swedes, in retaliation, burned its suburbs and devastated the surrounding area, making them and Mazeppa unpopular. December 9th, 1708, the Polish king sent a detachment of 500 people there, led by Lieutenant Colonel Funk. The population met the Swedes in the same way. The town of Terni, all the inhabitants, even women, fought against the Swedes. Funk's detachment, however, killed about 1,600 people, burned the town and the town of Nidrigailov, as well as all the remaining villages. This is mini mass murder here. Well, obviously, this expedition of Charles and Mazeppa, February 1709, failed miserably. But even if they had the resources and the forces, the weather changed everything. Russian weather, as everyone knows, is extremely unpredictable. Now, that winter was very nasty. Tons of snow and ice. But strangely enough, spring came in mid-February. There was this premature thaw. Way premature, along with severe rainstorms, and flooding occurred everywhere, washing everything away. Campaigning was out of the question. Well, the Russians hadn't even left the Hetmanate yet, and of course was expanding its territory, as they really had no other choice but to do. Your typical peasant is saying, God is saying, you're not going to do this anymore. Mazeppa, you've lost. The unsuccessful expedition led to an outbreak of a partisan war against the Swedes. You know, apparently the occupation by Sweden was not seen as liberation. Now, Sloboda Ukraine, which was formerly part of Russia, was for the Swedes enemy country. They already had extensive experience with its population. And Charles II got even worse. It's almost unanimous. Charles the 12th systematically and deliberately destroyed the territory he passed through. He annihilated everything. Now, he tried to justify it through military considerations, you know, the destruction of the enemy's hinterland, etc. But it also had something to do with the Swedes' revenge against this hostile population. The Lutheran memoirist, Daniel Kurman, who was sympathetic to Charles, said, Charles ordered cities and villages to be burned, houses to be demolished to the foundations, and the inhabitants to be slaughtered. Many thousands of cattle and herds were burned. I think his statements are significant because he, of course, a Lutheran, closely connected with the Swedish army. But the Swedes were not, you know, they admitted this too. They passed through the land with fire and sword. Everything in a 10-mile radius was destroyed. Towns like Grodnia, Kolomak, Ulishnia, Marafa, places like this, and all their surrounding villages, they're simply gone. Any idiot knows that this was now fatal for the Swedes. So the partisan war against Sweden was now reaching unprecedented heights. Ukrainian peasants were now at war with the Swedes and to a lesser extent with Mazeppa. And this is something that even, you know, Ukrainian nationalist historians, and I've been reading a lot of them recently, struggle with. I mean, they're honest enough to say that, yeah, you know, this has been destroyed. It's partially Mazeppa. It's partially Sweden's fault. And there really was no standard anti-partisan methods developed yet. It was, people were outraged. The population, for example, of the Seversk region also added their partisan methods. The Hungarian envoy to Charles XII, Daniel Kodman, as I mentioned, who accompanied the Swedes in the entire campaign, to 1709, he said the same kind of thing. And his diaries, his travel diaries, actually amazing. Of course, had to be translated. He wasn't Ukrainian by any means. Spring of 1709, now that everything had been wiped away, the Swedes were totally exhausted by the fierce winter. They were weakened by the lack of food, and now disease was coming in, and weakened by these kind of operations, their morale was zero. Kodaman himself says, in April 1709, the condition of the Swedes was very sad, but every day they expected even worse. The Ukrainian population, wherever possible, threatened the Swedish convoys and even the lives of the Swedes. The peasants, they hid in the forest, tried to profit from the Swedish booty at every opportunity. They wanted to finish Poltava off with hunger, but they themselves were falling under the force of the slow famine. Repressions caused orphanhood, resistance, repressions, and so it went on and on and on. The immediate consequences of these kind of diplomatic activities of Mazeppa was it amounted to nothing. There was a new Russo-Turkish war, and Russia actually was defeated in 1711 at Put. That was a consequence of Mazeppa's policy, but that wasn't a crushing defeat. Mazeppa was almost trying to tell the world that even under these conditions, I can still, as the leader of Ukraine, or he called himself, could create his own independent foreign policy. But that was mostly in his head. There was a modern Ukrainian chronicler, and I'm going to wrap this up now. He writes about it. The partisan, you know, when peasants essentially have nothing left to lose, did they go after the Russians? No. They went after the Swedes. It was difficult for them to attack Cossacks because at this point the Cossack forces were non-existent. The modern Ukrainian chronicler says the following, as far as the Ukrainian population is concerned. In the same year, 1708, 1709, little Russians secretly and openly beat the Swedes in their quarters and on the roads, and brought others alive to the sovereign, beating them in various ways and catching the strays. Because at that time, the snows were great and the winter was severe with frost, from which many Swedes died. And though few Swedes escaped from the army, a lot did not gain any more. They strayed and escaped. People caught them, or sneaking up on them with kindness, killed them. They treated the Swedes in forage for food, and from that Swedish army decreased in number greatly. And this is from the Lizo Gubowski chronicle, or it was summarized there. Now, it's a summary description. It kind of mixes together a whole bunch of local episodes. This is mostly in the Seversk region of October 1708. You had a very well-organized partisan movement in Slobozhansk, in the south of the Hetmanate, spring of 1709. But it was clear where the your typical peasant or low-level merchant, where their support was. And could you imagine had that been Turks? It simply was absolutely out of the question. And at one time or another, Ukrainians seeking to unify both left and right bank, brought in whoever they can grab onto. You know, Doroshenko with Turkey. Yeah, can you please promise me you're not going to loot these areas? Oh, sure, we won't loot them. Of course, they did immediately. And he's still lionized in Ukrainian historiography. Desperate people do things like this. The Ukrainian cause was, as far as an independent state was concerned, was never very good. They always needed very powerful allies. And those powerful allies either abandoned them or exploited them. These were the consequences of Mazepa. Culturally, religiously, he did wonderful things. The Baroque is a beautiful aesthetic. My favorite church of all time, in fact, is St. Andrew's, which was stolen from the autocephalous who had consecrated many Russian true Orthodox bishops and given over to some crazy jurisdiction. Oh, and I just realized, finally, the patriarch is finally died at 140, whatever he was. The damage that he did, I mean, yeah, it's repairable, I know that, but he was a creature, and thank God that he's gone. That's very good news, and that's also relevant to what I'm talking about here. This is what Mazepa did, for better or for worse. It's very difficult to be objective completely. I try to be. He did many wonderful things, and he built many wonderful things. He created a cultural milieu that, of course, because of these military defeats, you know, has been totally destroyed. Ukrainian Baroque is worth your time to study. It's a beautiful aesthetic. Thank you, everyone, for listening, and I will talk to you next week. Bye-bye.